This week on World Affairs.
New alarm bells ringing tonight on the coronavirus outbreak in this country.
The COVID-19 coronavirus.
The number of new cases is literally growing by the hour.
Governments around the world and the World Health Organization are scrambling to contain what seems destined to be a global pandemic.
Keeping the country safe is the government's overriding priority.
We're concerned that in some countries, the level of political commitment and the actions that demonstrate that commitment do not match the level of the threat we all face. This is not a drill.
Hello, I'm Philip Yun, CEO of World Affairs. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED. It's made possible by the generous support of Chevron and TPG. Coming up, we talk with Larry Brilliant. He's a world-renowned epidemiologist and technologist.
This is not the zombie apocalypse, but this is going to change the world for the next 12 to 18 months.
We're also joined by Lori Garrett. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning global health journalist and author.
We're operating on such a primitive scale in the richest country in the world compared to what's going on right now in South Korea, in Japan, in Iran, in Italy. We should be ashamed of ourselves.
And we get dispatches from China, Iran, and Italy. Ray Suarez takes it from here.
As outbreaks of coronavirus cases spread around the globe, new countries announce their first case day after day. The epidemic spread now appears to be slowing in China.
They have reported their lowest number of COVID-19 cases in more than a month.
Though the majority of cases and deaths continue to be in China. Using unprecedented public health measures, life is beginning to return to normal in some cities. I've been watching the situation in Shanghai very closely.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing all right. A little tired.
Are things, what? How was today?
As has been endemic of the last couple weeks, it's after midnight and I'm sitting at my makeshift home office, which is like whatever chair we had in the apartment and the only free table in the apartment in a corner of the living room.
Well, now that you've said that, I'm sorry to call you so late at night, but, you know, the globe being what it is and all. For those who don't recognize your voice right off, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Rafael David Suarez, son of Rafael Angel Suarez Jr., and I live and work in Shanghai, China. I moved here in January, just before Chinese New Year.
So that's my son, and for today, a source. Oddly enough, is life getting back to normal?
It's shifting sideways into a weird new normal. We're seeing some of the same changes that you see post any big shift in China, where different mechanisms of control kind of just linger in place for a while. So both Alipay and WeChat, like two of the massive social apps in the country, have launched codes where you scan a QR code around the city just to reflect that you've been somewhere. And then if anyone was found to be sick in around the time that you were there, they'll alert you and a code that shows on your phone will change from green to yellow or red to warn you that you should go back to your home and stay in quarantine. Virtually everyone on the street is in masks. At this point, like whether it's a surgical mask or an actual respirator, it's just considered rude not to be wearing one if you're around other people.
Let's go back to that scanning. They're taking the surveillance apparatus that was already in place and ramping it up to a new level and saying, hey, we're doing this for you?
They're inventing new stuff on the fly, and it's a weird sort of government-private business partnership. Like both Jack Ma's Alibaba and Tencent's WeChat are working hand-in-hand with local police across the country to roll out some of these measures. The Chinese people that I know of, there's like an amazing resilience on the street of just being told, okay, you've done something for the rest of your life, but we're changing the way that works today. Here's how you do it. And people do it. There's a grand sense of like, okay, this is how I have to play by the rules now.
Since you brought up masks, I should tell you, mommy, when she wakes up every morning, rolls over, picks up her phone from the night table and looks at the Johns Hopkins a coronavirus app to see how many new cases there are, and she's on several occasions confidently told me that you always wear a mask. Do you?
So as I told you earlier, it's impolite not to be wearing one. So I actually, at my desk in the office, I have my commuting mask and then my like polite office mask. So I wear a heavy duty N95, actually a British mask, when I get on the metro and when I'm going through public spaces. And then when I get to the office, I take that off. And then if I need to go run down the hall past offices of other companies, I put on my simple surgical mask, which is much easier to breathe in and much quicker to take on and off. When I'm walking around, like I just, a bar I go to in central Shanghai finally reopened after a long period of being closed. And a couple of friends were like, hey, everybody, we should get together. They were expecting like 10 people to show up and three did. But like everyone was sitting around wearing masks, except when you'd take a drink, you'd slip your mask off, have a sip of your drink, put the mask back on.
Well, thanks for staying up late for me. And what can I tell you? Keep cool.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Back in the United States, new cases of the COVID-19 virus are reported on a daily basis. Health officials expect a big increase once more labs gain the ability to test for the virus. As Americans brace for the worst, many are asking, how serious will the outbreak be here? How deadly? And how long will it last? Our next guest has some answers. Let me begin by asking you to introduce yourself.
My name is Larry Brilliant. I'm an epidemiologist. I was a professor of epidemiology for many years. I worked for the World Health Organization.
Larry Brilliant is a technologist, physician, and, as he says, an epidemiologist. He's best known for playing a key role in eradicating smallpox, a scourge of humanity for centuries. He previously led the Skoll Foundation's Global Threats Fund, was founding director of Google.org, and was scientific advisor for the film Contagion. Larry is currently chairman of the Ending Pandemics Advisory Board. Welcome to the program. Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you.
Now, you've said that the coronavirus outbreak is reason for concern, but not panic. Why is that?
I think I try to say it in a little different way. I say this is not the zombie apocalypse. But, Ray, this is going to be a bumpy road, again, to use these, you know, this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. This is going to change the world for the next 12 to 18 months. And it will be lumpy and bumpy. There'll be outbreaks in states and countries. They'll be cleared up. They'll return again. Seasonality will play a small role in it. Travel and accidents will play a small role in it. But you have to realize that this is a novel coronavirus and that there's nearly 8 billion of us on the planet. None of us have immunity, except for a small handful, to this virus. Some of the best modelers that I've seen at Imperial College, Neil Ferguson and others, are modeling alternative scenarios that include the possibility that a third of humanity will be infected by this disease. The case fatality rate will go up or down, not because it really changes or the virus changes, but based on how rapidly we find light cases or how rapidly we report deaths. We're in for a tough time, but it is not a mass extinction event. I hope we'll learn a lot from this and reinvest in preventing zoonotic diseases like this. You've interviewed me before. You know that there have been 50 animal viruses, zoonotic viruses, that have jumped from animals to humans, Ebola, SARS, MERS, H1N1, H5N1, swine flu, bird flu, West Nile. And this is part of modernity and our destruction of the world between animals and humans. And in the way that we have, by overpopulation and travel, created petri dishes of our own all over the world.
Just a jargon check, Larry. When this is called the novel coronavirus, why is that term used, novel?
Because it has never, this particular virus has never presented itself to human beings that we can tell. It's possible that it circulated you know, in China before we found the outbreak. But it's novel, which means that our individual immune system and our collective ancestral immune systems have never dealt with it. And, you know, it's a coronavirus, and there is a class of coronaviruses that are just colds. 200 different cold viruses, about half of them are coronaviruses. And we get some viruses and we get lifelong immunity. We get other viruses and we don't. Smallpox, you get lifelong immunity to. Measles, chickenpox, more or less. There's some changes with that. We're not even sure that this virus will confer lifelong immunity. It may be possible to become reinfected later. It's novel in the sense that our immune system has never seen this particular combination of the roulette wheel of genomic combinations that are in this coronavirus.
You mentioned earlier that we are like one vast Petri dish. Before people got on airplanes and cruise ships, before people moved from one side of the planet to the other routinely and quickly in a matter of hours, were there viruses of this kind that just emerged, flared, and simply died out, hit a dead end?
I'm confident that there were. I'm also certain that there were some that managed to infect everybody, even though there weren't cruise ships and there weren't airlines. I give you the 1918 Great Influenza, which is reported to have traveled around the world four times in 1 year, and there were no airplanes or cruise ships. Viruses can travel a lot faster than we think. We've added to that with cruise ships and airplanes, in particular airplanes, of course. Yes, I think that there's some puzzlement in the epidemiological community about why MERS or SARS has, on occasion, had one strain of the epidemic that just died out. There's some hope that this novel coronavirus will, in some instances, die out. But there are so many different outbreaks simultaneous in the world right now, hundreds or thousands, that we don't even know about, the so-called community transmission. This disease is not going to go away by itself. We don't have an antiviral. We will not have a vaccine for 12 to 18 months. I'm sure you saw the meeting of President Trump's staff meeting when Tony Fauci interrupted him to stop him from saying we'll have a vaccine in 3 months. We wish we could, but it will be 12 to 18 months, and we need to prepare for the long haul, Ray.
If you look at a map of the world, and there have been rolled out various apps and monitoring sites, you'll see circles of different size popping up in countries all over the world. As someone who's been through this, as someone who studies it, when you look at that map and see a new country emerge, what does that tell you? Is there anything, in fact, that a country can do to shield itself from joining that long list of countries that have confirmed cases?
I'm not so worried about whether a country will or will not get that first imported case. I can't imagine that any country, other than by a kind of stochastic random process, would avoid getting one imported case. You think of the Belt and Road Initiative. You think of all the Wuhan, the 5 million people from Wuhan that left before there was any containment. What I worry about the most is those countries that are not reporting a case. I look at Zimbabwe. I look at Venezuela. I look at failed states, countries that have poor healthcare infrastructure. And the fact that they are not reporting a case doesn't mean they don't have cases or haven't received that importation. It must mean to me that they are not capable of distinguishing normal influenza or colds or even malaria sometimes, diseases that look similar in the early days to the coronavirus. I mean, look at the United States. We had only 200 test kits for all of California. That's immoral. That's, you know, how would we know that we had more than 200 cases if we did? So unless and until we have ubiquitous, low-cost, or free testing, along with the infrastructure that someone can just get a test done without having to pay a huge hospital bill, we're not going to know where this disease is. And if that's true for the United States, what is it like for Afghanistan, and God help us, for Syria, and for refugees that are waiting to get into Lesbos in Greece right now?
When you look at what's happened in Washington State, a hotspot pops up. Right away, people start to talk about who was where, who was with who. I mean, contact tracing is part of the standard armory for people trying to trace the spread of a disease. But then it emerged several days later, given the incubation period for this disease and what we're coming to understand about it, that the Washington State cluster has been percolating for many weeks, long before we had an identified case. Does this part of the profile of the disease just make everything harder?
Yes. I mean, you know, if you have Ebola, it has a very high death rate. You're not going to miss deaths. If you're thinking as an epidemiologist looking at a surveillance program, we will find the deaths. In smallpox, you couldn't get the disease unless you had it literally physically on your face. So we didn't have these lighter cases that eluded even good surveillance. And we do not have good surveillance. We have a couple of good systems. We have HealthMap and Flu Near You. We have some CDC's reporting systems. Johns Hopkins is doing an excellent job every week. We've got digital disease surveillance systems. We've got an increasing attention to try to find these cases early. But this new idea of community transmission is just a way of saying, we don't know where it came from. And when we talk about it having been in community circulation for 6 weeks, and the incubation period, while it is reported to be between 2 and 14 days, and I give them the leeway of creating a very large confidence interval, it's probably 6 days. The outbreak is doubling pretty much every week. But if it's a 6-day incubation period or generational time, and it's been circulating for 6 weeks, and it doubles every week, it doesn't take much math or much imagination to realize how much unknown coronavirus is in the community. Now, that having been said, we do find some really good things about this virus for our sake. It is true that 2/3 to 80% of the people who contract it will have a light disease that looks much more like ordinary flu than it does like SARS or MERS. That's true. And it is true that unless our medical care and hospitals are overwhelmed, we have adequate palliative measures to make that experience with the virus less onerous. But we do not have surge capacity. The UK announced its plan yesterday. The biggest issue that they face is even controlling the entire national health system in the UK, they cannot make available enough beds to provide for simultaneously taking care of somebody with epidemic coronavirus and the heart disease and cancer patients that they normally have as their load. That's what I say, we don't have surge capacity. We may find ourselves in a situation, a difficult situation, of having to try to do what China did, building special hospitals for coronavirus. We won't be able to do it with the speed and alacrity that they did it. So I'm very worried about what the pressure on our ordinary healthcare system will be from the coronavirus.
I was in Mexico during the emergence and then the explosion of H1N1. And one of the most exciting things about covering that story, and of course it was terrible to see human suffering and death, but the way you learn what a virus does, how it affects people over time, and that time is very compressed, was fascinating to me as a layman and a reporter trying to explain it to others. Now, we've got 51,000 people who we know had the disease and have recovered from it. Is there something they can be teaching us?
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Again, going back to the UK plan, just because it's fresh in my mind, it came out yesterday. They have estimated that 1 in 5 workers in the UK will be sick at the same time during the course of this pandemic. They're saying that 20% of the workforce will be sick at one time. Now, you think about what that does for home health care visitors who are going to go to visit your mom or your grandma in a nursing home. That's 1 in 5 fire workers, and it's 1 in 5 doctors. It's 1 in 5 everything. I don't know if that number is right, but let's just take it as an indicator that a lot of people will be out of work. How can we certify when they come back into the workforce that they've had the disease and they are immune, and therefore it is safe for them to go and work in hospitals, safe for them to work with other firefighters together, safe for them, in fact, to not spread the disease? We need to invest today, again, in a simple, home, easy, immunological test that shows both that you've had the disease and you're immune, because they're different things. You may have had it, but be still carrying it. You may have recovered from it and lack immunity. We need to be thinking now, because we're going to need that in 3 months.
You recently were part of a decision to cancel a conference that draws people from all over the world to the UK. It's a big conference with a lot of moving parts and people who come from every corner of the planet. Was it a tough call to make?
Yes, it was a very tough call to make. And I'm getting requests from a lot of people. You know, in Silicon Valley, almost all of the big national meetings have been canceled. Many foundations that hold gatherings have canceled them. But this event in Oxford is a very precious event for our community. We give out $1.5 million grants to social entrepreneurs, and we bring them on stage and we celebrate their achievements like they were movie stars, because we deeply feel that the people who are making the world a better place should get the accolades that the people who are making better movies. And there's something about the way we've set this up, the Skoll World Forum, that 1,000, 2,000 young social entrepreneurs come together from 100 countries. It's also the time in Oxford where the students are on vacation, so students from Italy and Spain come in and flood in as wannabe students or as tourists into Oxford. And when people say to me, should I be worried about an event, I ask, does that event look like it's a sterile event, or does it look like a cruise ship? And unfortunately, what we found, all the things that we tried to structure into this event in Oxford, the intimacy, the shared meals, the, you know, reshuffling the deck so that people from Africa met people from Norway, and all those noble things, it made the event look a lot more like a cruise ship. And it put us in a moral quandary that if we want to first do no harm, we had to cancel this.
Larry, brilliant. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Ray, thanks very much. Nice to talk to you.
Over the past week, the fastest growth of new coronavirus cases has been outside China.
It's another day in lockdown for tens of thousands of Italians cut off from the rest of the world.
Tonight, coronavirus is on every continent but Antarctica and surging in South Korea.
And Iran's supreme leader has put the country on a war footing. 300,000 soldiers and volunteers could be mobilized.
Among the hardest hit countries so far, Iran.
News of the virus dominated conversations in Tehran.
Peter Kenyon is NPR's international correspondent.
If any Iranians had faith in their government's promises to defeat the coronavirus, that faith was likely shaken when they saw the video posted by the man in charge of combating the virus, Deputy Health Minister Iraj Harirchi. A day after giving a press conference at which he mopped sweat off his face repeatedly, Harirchi announced that he too was sick. I would like to inform you that I also got corona, he said, adding that he had isolated himself and was beginning treatment. He repeated the government's assurances, saying, quote, we will defeat the corona.
Peter joins us from his base in Istanbul, Turkey, and Christopher Livesey is an independent journalist based in Rome, Italy. He joins us now from the Veneto in northern Italy. Peter Kenyon, you're just back from Iran. This is a place with a very high death rate, a very large number of cases in a very short period of time. Does Iran have what we would call a robust national health system, or is this a place where, it's pretty badly resourced or unable to reach into every corner of the country?
Well, certainly Iran suffers under American sanctions. Things like medicines and foods are technically exempt, of course, but a number of banks have been very skittish about secondary sanctions against them, so they have been reluctant to approve transactions on all kinds of goods. So, yeah, it is a little bit difficult. The health care system is pretty robust, actually, although the WHO, the World Health Organization, today was pointing to lack of gear, protective gear for healthcare workers as an urgent problem that needs to be addressed. Also, things like oxygen supplies, respirators, ventilators. So these kinds of issues are coming up.
Christopher Livesey, how is Italy different and similar?
Well, it's different in a very unfortunate way right now. It has, at least for the time being, even more dead than Iran. It's also important to point out that people have recovered, but the fatality rate has spiked quite a bit. Italians have been taking coronavirus in stride. At first, when it was reported in February 21st, to be precise, there was a bit of panic. There was a rush on supermarkets, specifically, hand sanitizer and face masks, just the kind of bulk buying we were seeing or seeing right now in the United States. But then, as time went on, people kind of got used to it. And they saw that those particularly vulnerable were the elderly. And this is a country that has a very high population of elderly. I mean, it's the second oldest population in the world after Japan. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing the high number of infected and also this spiking death rate. As far as daily life is concerned, news announced today was that the entire country was going to shut down its schools, and that includes, elementary schools, universities, clown colleges, you name it, they're all shutting down until the middle of the month. And so the country is certainly taking it very seriously and just hoping that it's going to reach the peak sometime soon, because it's taking a massive toll on the economy, specifically the tourism industry. The government estimates that it's lost around $7.5 billion since the outbreak began. And this is not anywhere close to a peak tourism season in Italy. So if this thing continues on into the spring and summer, it's going to be devastating to an economy that's already lagging behind the rest of Europe.
We're in Lenten season and on the road to Easter. It's hard to imagine a place like St. Peter's Square in Rome not thronged with pilgrims, but it sounds like that's what may be in the offing.
That's absolutely what's happening. I mean, one of the places where this was most pronounced was in Venice. I mean, right during the carnival season that takes place right before Lent. It's a festive time. People are dressed up as characters from Commedia dell'arte. They had to take off those masks early and swap them with surgical masks. They called an end to the carnival 2 days before it was supposed to come to an end. And this is a city that's really taken a 1-2 punch. Because just before coronavirus hit, they had this massive flooding at the end of last year that also turned off tourism effectively. And it was just starting to climb back over that slump when coronavirus happened. So now that city is on its knees. They estimate in Venice locally that the city alone has lost over $1 billion in tourist money, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better.
Peter mentioned that the disease in Iran has touched virtually every part of the country. In Italy, has it remained concentrated in one northern province?
not concentrated, but definitely I mean, it's pretty diffuse throughout the entire country at this point. I mean, there are definitely towns and provinces that haven't seen it yet. I mean, right now, for instance, I'm in a town called Bassano del Grappa. I happen to be visiting my in-laws. My wife is Italian, and she's from this town. And this town hasn't had any reported cases of coronavirus. However, it is also inside the region of Veneto. That's the same region that Venice is in. And it is one of the hardest hit regions. It's not far from Milan in the region of Lombardy, which has been the hardest hit region in Italy. So it's a little scattershot, but there have been cases pretty much throughout the entire country. The north has seen the worst of it. In fact, it's already had its schools shut down. It's had, you know, soccer matches that have been played behind closed doors without any fans in the stadiums. I mean, it's a pretty remarkable images. I'm sure you can Google them, and it's stunning. I mean, life is shut down. You go onto a train, there's nobody on board. The train stations are empty. It feels rather eerie outside.
Now, Peter, one thing that's remarkable about Iran, at least from the early coverage, is that the cases are not confined to unknown people, anonymous people who happen to live in one town or another.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. I mean, we have many senior officials infected, two vice presidents, a woman named Masumeh Ebtekar, and the first vice president, Eshak Jahangiri. They have it. Also, the man in charge of combating the virus, the deputy health minister. He showed up at a briefing for the media, mopping sweat from his face repeatedly, and then he announced the following day that he too was infected. Now, they're trying their best. Friday prayers have been canceled again this week. Major public events have been scrapped. Schools and universities remain closed. And when I was in Iran, the pharmacies in particular were being mobbed. There were just huge lines there. But by this point, it seems there are very few people out and about in Iranian cities.
Christopher, before I have to move on, some of the reporting from Italy would indicate that the country may not be disproportionately affected by the disease, just have a better testing and screening regimen. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's a really important point. And I think there's a cultural reason for that, as well as a governmental one. I mean, they have universal health care here, so they're able to enact these kinds of sweeping checks across the population. They were very aggressive in diagnosing the disease, while other countries, were administering tests here and there on the population. Italy was the fastest in Europe. In the first week alone, it issued 3,500 swabs. And so the consensus is that it might have a lot more to do with detection as opposed to the actual disease spreading further here. Whenever there's the threat or the risk of some kind of contagion, Italians tend to take these things very seriously, but they also are known for kissing each other on the cheek when they greet each other. And so they've definitely had to make some changes in their lifestyle as well.
Christopher Livesey joins us from Northern Italy. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
And NPR's Peter Kenyon, a pleasure to have you with us. In the 2011 bio-thriller film Contagion, a novel virus emerged from China and quickly spread throughout the world, killing 26 million people.
On day one, there were two people, and then four, and then 16. In 3 months, it's a billion. That's where we're headed.
The outbreak wasn't real. It was a Hollywood depiction of how a modern, viral, global pandemic would play out. Now we're in the midst of a very real outbreak of the COVID-19. And there's one main similarity between the fictitious outbreak and the one we're experiencing now. The world is unprepared.
40 to 70% of the world's adult population could be infected.
To understand just how unprepared and what can be done to change the tide, we turn to Lori Garrett. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and expert on global health. Her books include The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance, and Betrayal of Trust, the Collapse of Global Public Health. Lori, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Now, you said in recent days that this outbreak could have been handled easily, contained, controlled weeks ago, but it wasn't. How could this have been different?
Well, there are two key junctures at which we could have turned the tide and stopped this damn thing. And in both cases, governments made the wrong choices. The first was in December, when the virus was circulating in Wuhan, China, and healthcare workers brought it to attention. They told their higher-ups and they told each other that it looked a lot like SARS, and they paid a huge penalty for doing so. They were chastised. The official position of the Communist Party in China was, nothing's wrong. Don't look behind this curtain. Pay no attention to that man shouting over there. And by the way, we're probably going to throw him in prison. And so we lost a crucial period of time that extended from roughly Christmas to about January 19th. And on January 19th, Xi Jinping finally told the Communist Party throughout its entire national infrastructure, cut it out. We have to be open. And they even issued an edict that anybody who covered up would face eternal shame, which is, you know, that's a long time. And the result was suddenly a flood of reports, and suddenly you saw the case numbers skyrocket in China. They were not new cases, they were just long covered up cases. The second juncture when the world could have made a difference in this epidemic is this long period when China goes all out to control their epidemic, you know, in various to various degrees, places 100 million human beings on one form of lockdown or another, you know, mobilizes the entire nation to fight this disease, and effectively eventually brings their numbers down to the point where we're getting just dribbles of case reports now. Well, during that period, the whole rest of the world should have been in get ready mode. We should have all been developing good, reliable assays so that we could quickly diagnose the disease and tell who was infected and who wasn't. Not just in the hospital with a two-day turnaround time in the laboratory, but an actual field test that could walk right up to somebody on a subway platform and tell immediately whether or not that individual was infected. We should have been using this time to see what's left of our infrastructure for fighting disease and what's the chain of command from the president all the way down to local public health officials. Who's in charge of what? What's a police responsibility? What's a public health responsibility? What's an individual physician responsibility? On and on and on. And we did none of these things. Zero. Zip. And it's not just the United States did none of these things. Country after country after country failed to do what they should have been doing during this window of opportunity when China delayed the spread on a global scale. And now we're all going to pay the price for the incompetence of our relevant governments.
Let's talk about the mechanics of disease spread. If China had been more upfront earlier, what would have changed about the way it passed from person to person and, in effect, got established and got going before measures were finally put in place?
Well, there's a maxim in public health. I think Larry Brilliant hit on a couple of these points earlier, and that is, it's easier, in fact, easy usually, to stop an outbreak when it's a handful of cases. As the cases spread, the difficulty in stopping an outbreak magnifies dramatically, I would argue exponentially, as you jump in more and more complex dispersal of cases. The problem is, when there are only a handful of cases, politicians, and in every kind of political system, tend to say, but it's only a handful of cases. What's all the hullabaloo? Why do I need to corral resources? Forget about it. And then, of course, by the time they all wake up and realize they have a disaster on their hands, it's no longer easy to control.
The director of health emergencies for the World Health Organization, Michael Ryan, is now saying to wait, to be complacent, to be caught unawares, at this point, you have no excuse. Is the world, I know you walked us through how we lost a lot of time, is the world finally getting in harness, and what ideally would that look like?
No. The world is still acting as if this is somebody else's big problem. You know, it's Iran's big problem, it's Italy's big problem, it's South Korea's big problem, but here where we are, we'll just let our little local health department do their little local thing and we'll see if, you know, they're ready. The scale of mobilization necessary has only begun For example, only in the first week of March did we finally get World Bank committing serious resources to assist poor countries around the world in preparing for this darn thing. And that was a $12 billion commitment to be dispersed across sub-Saharan Africa and other resource-scarce areas of the planet. Only in the last several days have we heard from World Health Organization that there's such severe hoarding and price gouging on masks, gloves, protective gear for healthcare workers, and so many people who are never going to need them are hoarding the supplies for average person whilst placing nurses and doctors at risk of their lives, that the entire global supply chain is in danger and of total collapse, that we need to increase on the scale of 40 million masks per day, the scale of production around the world. And yet, everybody's acting like, well, somebody else will do it. You know, Japan will make them. Philippines will make them. I don't know who's going to make them. Who's going to sell them? Where are they going to be distributed? We are so far behind the curve on all of this. And Wall Street and other major stock markets are responding in this boomerang fashion where one day they get a piece of news that makes them freak out and the market plummets by 4 or 5%. And the next day they get some piece of news and decide, oh, maybe it's not such a big deal, and the market goes up 4 or 5%. And all of this is creating tremendous economic turmoil all over the world. You have major economic interests facing losses that are incalculable, in the trillions, in the scale of money the average human being can't even wrap their brain around. And then you have the lead agencies responsible for protecting humanity begging for millions. It's log scale differential.
You know, there's that old saw that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. When you cast your eyes over the globe, there are national health systems that spend, you know, billions of euros, pounds, dollars per year on their people. And there are countries that spend relative pennies on their populations. Is there anything that the poorest countries on the planet, which want to do well by their people, can do to make up for their lack of resources when trying to stop the spread, isolate the ill, and get a handle on this thing?
Well, I have 3 points to make about that question, which is a good and important question. The first is, if we draw from the experience of SARS in 2003, and I was in the SARS epidemic in China and Hong Kong, and then subsequently investigated the SARS responses in Vietnam, Singapore, and Thailand. And it's very striking that one of the countries that had the hardest time stopping SARS in its midst, and 3 times said they had stopped it and 3 times were wrong, was one of the most advanced healthcare systems on earth, Canada, and their continuous recycling of SARS through their hospital system in very sophisticated hospitals in Toronto. And in contrast, the country that got rid of SARS the fastest, even before there was any real science in the earliest stages of the pandemic, was Vietnam. And it did so by moving its patients out of a sophisticated hospital into Bac Mai Hospital, a very ancient public facility that had been bombed repeatedly by the Nixon administration during the Vietnam War. And it had no air conditioning. They just opened the windows and placed the SARS patients next to open windows. And guess what? Their epidemic stopped. So sometimes the low-tech approach is the better approach. It can be argued that one of the reasons we have so much trouble with coronaviruses, this whole class of viruses, is that they produce really, really profound pneumonia in the patients. And in wealthy countries, we treat these patients with valiant efforts that involve intubation and a lot of devices that are potential sources of spread of infection, and with very intensive labor on the behalf of healthcare workers that are at risk with what they're doing. And it may really be that it's those valiant efforts in the richest countries in the world that are causing the biggest outbreaks and spread within hospitals. And so, it's not necessarily a clear-cut story that rich world equals less spread and poor world equals more spread and death. But there's a second part to this answer. We finally see the World Bank saying we have to take this seriously and mobilize some resources to help poor countries get ready. Well, I mean, we should have been mobilizing those resources for years, but at least finally there may be some preparedness, and that is a hopeful sign. And then I think finally, I would say this. There is some really great science going on in sub-Saharan Africa right now. And thankfully, we've seen the creation of an African CDC, which it was created in response to the 2014 Ebola epidemic. Many of the African CDC personnel have cycled through the current Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they've learned important lessons. They've really honed their skills in infection control and in community response. And they've dealt with very hostile community, armed community that has shot at doctors and nurses, and learned a lot of lessons about social mobilization. And so I think in many ways, Africa is better prepared today than they would have been just 4 or 5 years ago.
One thing that's gotten a lot of attention, and this is kind of an outgrowth of what national systems and national preparedness can do, is the lack of ability, the lack of kits, the lack of willingness to test large populations. Is it worth it early in a disease to test a lot of people when you're assuming that you're going to get a lot of negatives?
The only way you can understand the dynamics of spread in any given community, I'm here in New York, and we have a very mysterious potential beginnings of an outbreak just outside our city to the north. The only way we could really understand what's going on is to test very large numbers of people. Now, in this case, and it's a perfect example of the dynamic I'm talking about, we have an individual who's been hospitalized in more than one facility, actually three, over a period of a couple of weeks, complaining of pneumonia. And because our Centers for Disease Control didn't have test kits and set very strict requirements that a patient had to meet in order to qualify for a test kit, meaning they had to have been in China or been close to somebody who was in China, this individual didn't fit the criteria, so nobody tested this individual to see, are you not infected? Meanwhile, the individual exposed potentially very large numbers of healthcare workers. Those healthcare workers potentially went home, exposed their family. Some of those family members may have gone to other workplaces, to schools, to churches, to community meetings, to sports events, to entertainment events. We're now just beginning an investigation to understand, is this still just one isolated individual? We have no idea where this person got infected or how. Or is this the tip of the iceberg of an already existent large outbreak in Westchester County, New York State? And without the ability to test people and determine who may be infected but have no symptoms, we have no idea what the answer to that question is and what level of alarm is appropriate for the people of the state of New York.
Is it complicated? Is it difficult? And I guess we can talk about whether it's expensive, too, to simply produce the number of kits you need to screen large populations.
The problem we're in right now is unique to the United States. So let me be very clear. You know, there's 100,000 test kits in use right now in Iran. China has developed several different types of test kits and used, you know, tested millions of people across China. And yet here we are, the most advanced economy, the most advanced scientific society on earth, and we don't have a damn test worth a damn. Why? We didn't invest appropriately in our CDC. In fact, the Trump administration cut the CDC budget repeatedly, and the lab responsible was down to a skeleton crew. Big mistakes were made. They ended up producing a test that once dispersed to the states turned out to be contaminated and did not function appropriately. We only just this last few days had the Trump administration agree to allow the FDA to approve commercial tests made by private manufacturers for use at the state levels and in hospitals across America. We're probably, and I'll go out on a limb here and say it, we're probably well past stage one of our outbreak in America. We are probably already entering stage two. Stage two meaning that we have pockets of spread within communities and that some of those communities are connected to each other, even across vast distances. We're at the stage where we should have already been testing hundreds of thousands of people. We should already have gone through hospitals all across America and tested all of the pneumonia patients that have unknown etiology pneumonia, meaning we know clearly it's not bacterial pneumonia, and we know the individual did not have influenza. So every one of those, everybody in an ICU, intensive care unit right now, suffering from pneumonia should be tested for COVID. But we don't have test kits. We don't have the tests. Hospitals don't have them. And even the ones that are now beginning to come offline from commercial manufacturers are not mutually calibrated. So we have, it's apples and oranges, you know. One locality might buy a test from company A and another locality from company B, and one test will have one level of sensitivity and specificity and the other one will have another level. And so we won't even have a good national sense of what's going on with our epidemic. We're operating on such a primitive scale in the richest country in the world compared to what's going on right now in South Korea, in Japan, in Iran, in Italy. We should be ashamed of ourselves.
Lori, before we go, I wanted to talk to you a little about what these last several weeks have meant for you, because covering public health as a beat is an underpopulated discipline in American journalism. And when stuff finally hits the fan and people really need to know things, it falls disproportionately on someone like you. What have the last couple of weeks been like?
Oh, boy. I'm so exhausted and fried, burned out. I can't even remember feeling like this since, you know, college finals week cramming, except that it's not a week. It's now been 8-9 weeks, and there's no end in sight. In fact, I think we're just at the beginning of this pandemic and that this is going to go on for months and months. It's been pretty dreadful. I mean, one of the things that, having been in at least 30 epidemics and covered God knows how many all over the world, there are certain common features that arise every single time. You know, when in the early stages of an outbreak, we, the messengers, are always accused of being chicken little, always attacked for sensationalizing, exaggerating, raising alarm unjustifiably, and so on. And then, you know, once things get out of control, we find ourselves surrounded by a cacophony of screamers, most of whom have no idea what they're talking about and are, in fact, rumor mongers. It's so much worse now, though, because I think even the most rational of human beings right now, with a college education, let's even add a background in biology, would have a hard time discerning fact from fiction in the current noisy atmosphere of daily news that is just overwhelming. I've never seen something so globalized, so fast, demanding 24/7 attention on my part. And I do fear that I'm on the edge of serious burnout. It's almost beyond human capability. And now you could say, and I've certainly had family tell me this, back off. Just put in an 8-hour day. Pace yourself. This is going to go on. It's a marathon. It's going to go on for months. But the problem is, I really do feel, having been the first person to write a book saying that we were facing this massive emerging disease threat worldwide of viruses, bacteria, and all sorts of other kinds of diseases, published way back in 1994, and having been at this issue for so long, I do feel a moral responsibility to try and be out there with as much accurate information as I can possibly convey, especially given the huge amounts of misinformation coming from our political leadership. And if we had a whole tier of scientists allowed to speak openly and to talk to the media openly, then I might be able to get by with an 8-hour workday, knowing that somebody else was putting out the information. Somebody else was telling America what America needed to know. But unfortunately, we are not in that situation. We're in the diametrically opposite situation. And so I feel like I and a handful of colleagues, all of us usually competitors, are now, you know, trying to boost each other's moral spirits and you know, note flagging energy and helpfully keep each other accurate, pass information back and forth in a way that I've never seen before. And we all realize we're in this for the long haul, and it, you know, if one of us burns out, the other one's going to have to pick up the flag and run with it.
Well, thanks for making time for us, and take care of yourself. Great to talk to you. Lori Garrett.
Thank you, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We're more than a program. We're a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that transcend borders. Please join our community and visit us at worldaffairs.org. We just heard from Lori Garrett. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning global health journalist and author. Her books include The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance, and Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. Earlier, we heard from Larry Brilliant, Peter Kenyon, Christopher Livesay, and Rafael Suarez. They were all talking about the coronavirus outbreak. Ray Suarez hosted the program. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED. We had engineering help from Robert Frazier. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.